Hi there, and welcome to this episode of Take Home Reading, a new audio series from the Wheeler Centre. In each episode, we'll be speaking to an Australian writer about their latest book and hearing a reading from it. This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation. The Wheeler Centre acknowledges their elders, past and present. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and to the elders of all lands this broadcast reaches. I'm Stella Charles and I work in the programming team at the Wheeler Centre. Usually I host our monthly reading series, The Next Big Thing, but since we haven't been able to gather together for a few months now, we thought we'd bring these readings to you instead. Today I'm chatting to Kirsten Alexander. Kirsten was born in San Francisco, raised in Brisbane, and now lives in Melbourne with her partner and two sons. Half Moon Lake was her first published novel. Her second novel, Riptides, was published in February with Penguin Random House. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi, Stella.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your book, Riptides?
Riptides is a novel that's set in mid-1970s Brisbane. Brisbane's where I grew up, so it's a place I know pretty well, at least in the past. I've lived in Melbourne for a long time. But the story had to be set in the 70s, and it had to be set in Brisbane because it opens with a car accident, and I couldn't have mobile phones, couldn't have any easy way of getting people out of their situation. And I chose the 1970s as the setting for the novel because the 1970s in Australia were fascinating. It was a time of incredible change. It was a time of some terrible fashion and music, but also some incredibly progressive changes in Australia that have since gone, I think, to our detriment. It's when free healthcare was introduced, free education was introduced, Indigenous land rights were begun, women's health refuges opened, and troops were brought back from Vietnam. There were a whole bunch of social changes that were quite remarkable, and we were ahead of our time for a small country. Also, there was a lot going on in the environment. There was Cyclone Tracy, there was a huge flood in Brisbane. So it felt to me like a really interesting time to set a couple of characters who'd done something awful and had to reckon with their actions amidst this turbulence. So it felt like a busy, energetic space and place. So the story is basically about when you do something, you have to decide whether or not you can face up to the consequences of your actions.
It's your second published novel after the brilliant Half Moon Lake, but I read that it was the first manuscript that you drafted. I'm curious what it was like to work on this after the success of Half Moon Lake and going back to the drawer and picking it out again. What was that like?
It was very strange. The one thing I'd say to people who are listening is if you've written something and faced rejection, you're not alone. You already know that. But Riptides was rejected 26 times by publishers across Australia, partly because of the things I just said. It was set in the 70s in Brisbane, not at the time considered an interesting era or a glamorous place. So no one wanted it. So I gave up on it and felt a bit sad about that, but onwards, wrote Half Moon Lake. And then when I went back to this one, it was very curious because I knew that it hadn't this little book hadn't been wanted in the world, and now it was wanted because the times had changed. Trent Dalton, God bless him, had written a book set in Queensland that was enormously popular, and all of a sudden people thought maybe Queensland, maybe back in the day, there might be an audience for this. So I had to go back to it with fresh eyes and look after it as much as I had the first time.
You mentioned Trent Dalton there. I'm curious to know what you were reading or absorbing yourself in while writing Riptides. Are there any specific books that influenced you or that you felt were connected to this project in some way?
I didn't read anything that was connected to this project. I read a lot, but what I did do was watch a lot of films. The 70s as well was an incredible time for Australian cinema, partly, bringing politics back into it again, partly because there was a lot of government funding for cinema at the time. So people were able to make some incredible films. So I watched a lot of 1970s Australian films to listen to the way people spoke and to see how they dressed, to watch how they interacted with one another, that how men and women, you know, Jack Thompson and Helen Morse and whoever the Australian actors of the day moved with one another. So it was really about watching film and listening to some of that terrible music.
I love that. I think you were originally scheduled to appear at the Next Big Thing event at the Wheeler Centre before COVID-19. The theme was Australiana. Even hearing from you just now, like, I was going to ask if that theme resonated with you all when you think about your novel. It's pretty clear that it does. Is there anything else you'd like to add about that?
I was thinking about just the other day when someone asked me about writing about Australia of the past, what it makes you think about Australia of the present. And in some ways I thought it's not a straight line ever from the past to the present. Every single thing that happened in the past affects every single thing that's happening now. There's no question. But there's also this back and forth thing where maybe we were a bit better about some environmental things back in the 70s. We were definitely more terrible about gender things back in the 70s. We were a bit, I think about our country as it is still evolving. We're still coming into our own being, and I think we still have a lot to learn about how to treat one another and the space we're in. But some of the lessons we learned in the past, we just throw away very easily. I'm not sure if other countries do that, but Australia certainly seems to struggle to learn from our past.
Is there anything over the last few months in isolation that you've enjoyed just reading, anything distracting or comforting that you'd like to share with listeners?
Yeah, I have a few books here. It's not visual, is it? Julia Baird's Phosphorescence is gorgeous. And I'm halfway through it and I've enjoyed it very much, but I've had to stop because one of her messages in this book is about the incredible power of getting out in nature and reconnecting with the ocean and the trees. And I can't do that just now. Or maybe I can. Maybe I can start doing it now. But when I began this book, the writing's beautiful and she's got a huge heartbeat, but I can't get out in nature and do what she recommends. I also read a bunch of essays by Lydia Davis, who's an American writer. Lydia Davis has done incredible things with writing. She has some short stories that will knock you sideways that are just one or two sentences long, and others that are several pages long. And she's very wise, and so I love her a lot. And I also just finished reading Evie Wilde's The Bass Rock. I'm not sure how you say that, but that's another terrific book. Yeah.
Amazing. I've been finding Lydia Davis really comforting too. I think it suits my attention span right now.
Very wise, yes.
No, she is. I'd love you to read an extract from Riptides for us. Is there anything you need to say to set it up before you begin?
I thought I'd start at chapter one, page one, and this is where the two characters, Charlie and Abby, who are brother and sister, both in their mid-20s, are in a car together on a dark country road. And it's December 1974. Charlie has just arrived back in Australia, having lived in Bali for a while, so he's pretty jet-lagged. And Abby is his very responsible, more level-headed sister. And they're in the car and it's nighttime. Oh, and the one thing I wanted to say, again, to writers, before I read this is going back and reading these pages that I have been published and I can't change, I would like to rewrite the entire thing. And I don't know if other writers feel like this, but I look back at what I've done and think, good God, how did you not see that? So as I read, I'm keenly aware of the flaws, but I hope it's interesting for you nonetheless.
You're definitely not alone in that, I don't think.
But it's too late now, you know, it's paper. So this is in the voice of Charlie, the brother. Charlie is speaking. He's the driver in the car. I wake when Abby shouts. She reaches across me and grabs the steering wheel. A car horn brays. White beams flare at us, then pitch to the right. For an instant, a rump of blue metal shines in our headlights. I elbow my sister out of the way and take the wheel, leaning back hard so I don't slam my head into it. Abby flattens her hands against the dashboard as I brake and strain to control our sideways skid. She screams my name. We sling to one side of the narrow dirt road and the other car slings the opposite way. like wrong ends of a magnet made to meet. We slide to an angled stop, pointing into scrappy bushland. Dust swirls in front of our headlights, the only movement in a frozen moment. My window is open, but I don't hear a sound from the surrounding bush, the cicadas and creaky eucalypts dumbstruck. Abby and I stare through the windscreen at the dust, panting, coughing. Neither of us moves until the cassette ejects with a clunk, having played its silent end, giving way to static. Abby hits the off button, fumbles to get out of the car and walks through the settling dust. I don't follow her straight away. I'm clocking what just happened. What the hell just happened? I turn off the engine, feel the thumping drum of my heart, the heat where my jeans sink into ridged vinyl, a breeze through the open door. I watch my sister walk away, her long hair splayed across the back of her singlet like a web. Once I get out, I cross the road and stand on the thin verge, shaking my sore wrists. Down in the ditch, Abby stands next to the crumpled car, a blue Holden Premier stopped on the cusp of a roll, one front wheel and one back, not touching earth, the bonnet crunched against the trunk of a white gum, headlights still blazing. Abby's on her toes, yanking at the driver's side door handle. I slide down to join her. "Help me," she says. Instead, I go to the front of the car, worried she'll pull it down onto all fours, onto us. But it's pushed so firmly into the tree, pug-faced, there's no chance of that. I can see the driver, a woman, slumped across the steering wheel, glowing under the internal light. She has thick blonde locks shot through with caramel and gold. Blood oozes from her head. She's coated in shards of glass. "Charlie, help me. We have to get her out. You're not supposed to move. It'll blow up. I've seen it on TV." We stand side by side and pull on the handle, yelling at the woman to come too, poking her limp arm through the open window until the door gives. I'm jammed into the join of door and car when she falls out onto Abby. They hit the ground together, a mess of bloodied skin and hair and glass. Abby screams, "Get her off me. Get her off." I shove the door away from my chest, then squat beside them and lift the woman so my sister can get out from underneath her. We lay the woman on the ground's coat of leaves, sticks and bark. She's honey-skinned with a spray of freckles across her nose and cheeks. Her hair is incandescent even away from the light. She's beautiful and heavily pregnant. I look across at Abby. We're both open-mouthed, mirror images of shock. "Charlie," she whispers. I nod. "Wake up," Abby says, kneeling closer to the woman. She shakes her by the shoulders. "She's not sleeping." I speak more loudly. "Hey, lady, hey, can you hear me?" I stare at her. I'm not sure, but is this Stevie Nicks? "No, you idiot." Abby places two fingers on the woman's wrist. "It might be," I say. "You don't know." "No pulse." I hear panic in her voice. I put my hand on the warm skin of the woman's neck, pushing aside hair, but I'm shaking and can't be certain if I feel the throb of blood. I scan for movement under her closed eyelids, block song lyrics from filling my head. "See if you can feel her heartbeat." "Why me?" Abby asks. "I'm not touching her boob." "It's not a grope. We need to know if she's alive." She rests her palm on the woman's chest while I wait in silence. "Nothing." "Fuck," I exhale. "Holy fuck." Abby moves her hand to the woman's belly. The rolling lump lifts her fingers like a wave, pushing a board up and over, a shoulder maybe, or a foot. She jerks her arm back. "We need to get to a hospital. We'll drag her up to the road, move the car closer. Charlie?" It occurs to me that we didn't check if there was anyone else in the car. I yank open the heavy door, haul myself up onto the front seat. There's a bag on the floor of the passenger side, but nothing and no one else. "Charlie!" Abby shouts. "It's not going to blow up. That doesn't happen." I call back. "Come here." I clamber out and go to Abby's side. "She's alive?" Abby is holding up the woman's limp wrist. "Mum's ring." "No way." I frown at my sister. "No. How?"
Thank you so much for joining us.
You've been listening to Take Home Reading, a Wheeler Centre audio series. That was Kirsten Alexander reading from her novel, Riptides. It's published by Penguin Random House and available now. Please shop local and support new Australian work. We'll be back soon with another episode of Take Home Reading. Until then, visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.